This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Hey, welcome to Radio EcoShock. This week, it's a best of times, worst of times show. We start out with John Kohler, the Growing Your Greens guy on YouTube. John is an enthusiastic learner and teacher about urban gardening. He helped push me along the path to growing my own and juicing it as a great raw plant food. Our interview is full of lots of things you can do. I'm posting some links of my favorite John Kohler videos to get you started. And then it's off to New York City for a dose of the awful truth from the long-term nuclear guardian Helen Caldicott. In her time to speak on the second anniversary of the Fukushima Daiichi triple meltdown in Japan, Helen lays it out. Due to increased radiation, toxic chemicals, and climate change, life on Earth is in the intensive care unit, she says. The aging Caldicott tells us it's up to us. We are all physicians for the Earth now. It's a powerful speech from a powerful force for sanity. First, though, it's time to get you growing your greens. Warning, the following interview could change your life. Our guest John Kohler has changed a lot of lives. John inspires people to grow their own food wherever they are, even in your front yard or patio. He teaches you how, for free, on YouTube. Then John gets you drinking healthy green juice that you make from your garden. And if you think you're immune to all that, stay away from his videos. I couldn't. Literally millions of people have watched the Growing Your Own Greens channel on YouTube. John Kohler, a hearty green welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
Well, seriously, I've spent a ridiculous amount of time watching your home garden videos. Tell us how you went from, it looks to me, like from Chuck E. Cheese to a tan, fit guy we see on the screen now.
Wow, yeah, Chuck E. Cheese. Wow, you've done some research on me there. So, yeah, that was my last corporate job, and I had to leave the corporate world because I just wasn't agreeing with the policies and the politics and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, what happened to me is that I had what's called spinal meningitis, and actually I was hospitalized. In the hospital, the doctors told me that I might not make it out alive. So, you know, I was in my 20s at that point, and nobody wants to hear that, you know, news at any age, especially when you're in 20s and I just graduated college and I had my whole life ahead of me because, you know, I always took my health for granted, and like so many people do in today's society. And, you know, that was a big wake-up call for me that I needed to do something different to change my life, you know, and live healthier, because luckily through higher powers, I like to say, as I got out of there, because the medical system could not help me at that point. But I learned that I needed to change what I was doing so that I wouldn't end up back in the hospital again, because the doctors said that I had what's called complement immune deficiency, which is why I ended up in the hospital in the first place. They said I had defective genes due to my immune system. Because of this, what happened was I did some major dietary changes. Went to the, you know, plant-based diet, which is, besides being a lot more ecological and friendly for the environment, it's also really good for us, is what I learned. And so I did that for many, many years. And one of the principles I like to live in my life is a principle of CANI, C-A-N-I. It stands for constant and never-ending improvement. So always doing what I'm doing and try to just do one step better the next day in whatever aspect of my life, whether it's my diet, my gardening, my, you know, relationships or whatever. And what I learned after living on a plant-based diet for so many years is I was eating really good food, eating really clean food, but, you know, there was a way I could do better. And the way that I found was to actually start growing my own food and growing the most nutrient-dense food that literally money can't buy these days. And that's basically got me into gardening. I didn't, you know, have a farm or anything like that. I lived in a standard suburban tract home. And, you know, I just decided to take out my front lawn and build over raised beds and just start growing my food and grow high-quality food in a small amount of space, and to prove that it can be done, and also, more importantly, to share this information with people. Because, I mean, one of the promises I made when I was in the hospital that if I did get out, you know, I would not maybe value things like money that we're so taught to value as the priority in life, but, you know, to, number one, value my health, but number two, to give back and to live in service, you know, in this life. Because, you know what, just being there for the fellow man is really all we got in life, in my opinion.
Well, how would you introduce your Growing Your Greens channel to our radio listeners? I mean, you've got several hundred videos there.
Right, yeah. So my Growing Your Greens channel, I probably have actually over 750 videos. And it's really cool because, you know, in the early years, I just kind of did it for fun, just to show what's possible and to specifically show people how to start growing their own food in their front yard if they want to. Because when I got first started doing that, I mean, I'd already always had a garden, you know, since I owned my house in the periphery, you know, on the side of the yard and just growing a few things for fun, you know. And, yeah, I could supplement my diet out of my garden, but now my goal is to eat the majority of the food out of my garden. You know, I grow 90 to 95% of my vegetable needs year-round in California. But, yeah, you know, so you could really see the transition of how I do it, how to build your raised beds. If you want to convert your front yard to do that, and I caution anybody that wants to convert their front yard, is to check with your city or homeowners association first, because unfortunately in some places in the country it may actually be illegal to grow vegetables in your front yard, which I think is ludicrous. But, yeah, whether you want to grow them in your front yard or your backyard, I have videos that take you step by step from knowing nothing to how to set up the irrigation, to how to enrich your soil to grow some of the most nutrient-dense foods that you can. I have videos, you know, where I visit other gardens and other places. I go to garden shows to show the newest products that might help people. And what I like to do is I just like to fill people with tons of ideas and, you know, let them pick the cool concepts or the cool devices or things, you know, that may let them grow more at home and, you know, they can be successful, because that's all it is. It's just about doing it and seeing what happens.
Well, in several of your videos, you do talk about the square foot method. Did you take some inspiration from Mel Bartholomew and his square foot garden method?
Oh, absolutely. So that really is what got me started in the gardening, because, you know, you always think, you look on the back of a seed packet, the spacing is 24 inches per plant, and you're like, man, I don't have that much room, and I can't grow a lot of food in a small amount of space. But with the square foot gardening method, you're literally packing in the plants in a smaller, tighter density so that you can produce more. And, you know, I've even, you know, I don't know, experimented with what Mel Bartholomew's recommended spacing is on some plants and even made them maybe like an inch tighter. And with the high-quality soil that I'm growing in, I'm able to get away with that. And it seemed to have pretty good production for me.
Well, as you know, John, Mel completely changed his recommendations from his earlier book. Now he says, forget using the soil you've got. Build raised beds with compost, vermiculite, and peat moss. And that means people could grow in the city even if their soil is polluted. There really isn't an excuse not to grow now, is there?
No excuse at all. I mean, that's what I recommend. I mean, I brought in compost, and I grow, you know, in all compost. But definitely for most people, Mel's mixture is going to work and be a really good mixture. And that's what I recommend. You know, you should always build a raised bed and bring in the soil, because then you could have a more nutrient-rich soil, because you don't frankly know what's been grown in the soil in the front of your house or the back of your house, if it's been sprayed with stuff or if there's a lot of nutrition in there. But by bringing in the soil and whatnot, you can have the richest soil, which then you're going to be able to support the denser plant growth that I'm doing.
And you added a new wrinkle by suggesting people add rock dust to their soil mix and gardeners. Why is that?
Oh, the rock dust is, in my opinion, probably the next best thing after compost. So if compost is like the king, the rock dust and the trace minerals are the queen. You know, in standard agriculture, you know, conventional farming, even organic farming, you know, the main three minerals that most farmers are concerned with are NPK. And, you know, in nature, there's hundreds of minerals, or over 100 minerals. And if we're just adding three minerals back in the food that you're eating and everybody's eating has mainly three minerals in it, and then we're supposed to get our nutrients from the food we're eating. We're getting three minerals in our body, but what about all the other trace minerals? And to be healthy, a person needs all these different trace minerals, and we're supposed to take a little vitamin tablet supplement. But supplements to me are to supplement an inadequate diet. When people are eating inadequate vegetables grown on mainly three minerals, they're not getting an adequate diet, so supplementation might be necessary. But if you grow your food in all the trace minerals, you know, the plants will absorb what they need, and it's shown, and in my experience, I've shown and proven to myself that growing in trace minerals versus without, you get faster plant growth, more disease and pest resistance, also higher yields, but the kicker is the food tastes better. I mean, people always add salt and sugar to their foods because things just don't have a good flavor punch. But when you grow in the trace minerals, I mean, the foods really come alive, and I mean, your tomatoes could taste better than your neighbors. So that's a fun one, too.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Growing Your Greens host, John Kohler. Why don't we talk about a couple of shows you've done, and they are TV-quality shows, in my opinion. For starters, you made a great feature from the Riddall Green Partnership Farm in Cleveland, Ohio. The title is Aquaponic Urban Farm Grows Vegetables Through the Winter Snow. What did you find there?
Wow, that was definitely a really fun, you know, video. I was actually traveling in Cleveland, Ohio to visit actually the Vitamix factory. And at the same time, you know, whenever I travel, I always look for cool places to visit that could expose my viewers and also educate myself. Because, you know, one of the greatest things I've learned is that to be a better teacher, you got to become a better student. And I thank you for seeing them on her TV quality shoes. I try my best and have a little flip can, actually, that I make all my videos with, and I was never trained in this stuff. It's just my passion for teaching this. But at the Riddall Partnership, it was great to see that that's going on in the inner city, you know, and just all the work they're doing with their greenhouses and producing a lot of food there, and especially growing in the winter without additional supplementary heating. And that was the thing that really got me, you know. And, I mean, that's what I really want to get the message to people is that, you know, people think, oh, I can't grow in the snow. But even without using propane or electricity or any other heat source, you can grow certain crops in the winter. And actually at the Riddall Partnership, when I visited, one of the funnest parts of the video was I literally almost burnt my hand because we were in a little hoop house that they built. And they had a hot compost pile. And I stuck my hand in the middle of the compost pile. I took it out, and then my hand was red. Because it was just so hot, and the compost, which you can make for free, they're using like spent brewery waste and, you know, other waste to make that compost hot and make the bacteria work, and they put out heat as a byproduct, but that also kept their hoop house hot enough to grow some of the cool crops during the wintertime, even when it was snowing outside, and plus because they had a little hoop house over with the plastic, you know, that kept it warmer and let the sun in, and also actually they pile up, you know, around the side to help keep it a little bit more insulated.
Yeah, using that compost pile to keep the greenhouse warm was genius, I thought. The only thing I couldn't believe or understand is they were raising tilapia fish there, and you showed enough detail on the construction that anybody could build one, I think. But you said the fish needed 80-degree Fahrenheit water, and I had to think, well, they've got to have some kind of water heater to keep that temperature up right through an Ohio winter. Did they?
Yes, absolutely. So I like the greenhouses where they weren't using the fish and they were using the composting for heating. But, yes, they did have some greenhouses where they do, you know, use supplementary heat to grow food. And if I think about it, you know, I really want people to do the best they can. I'd much rather them use some supplementary heating to grow their own food instead of shipping the food from California to the East Coast in the wintertime, which I think, you know, on an ecological scale is much more devastating in many respects. Plus, the fresher the food, the higher the nutrient quality. Plus, when you're growing it yourself, you could control all those aspects. And the other thing I want to add is that they also were researching other types of fish to use that would not need warmer water, so they could use less heat and still produce, you know, what they're doing under the aquaponics.
Right, maybe trout. Well, you had one more cool video I wanted to talk to you about. Your tour of the commercial sprout growing operation at gotsprouts.com in Florida. That was gold, those inside secrets to growing sprouts. What surprised you the most there?
Wow, yeah, I really like doing the tours. When I get to show, you know, my viewers and anybody that wants to watch, like, the inside technologies and secrets, hints and tips of all these places that actually make a business out of growing sprouts, but at the same time, they're glad to share their trade secrets with people, and I'm glad that I could be able to share those with people because, you know, to me, like, the world, what it's turning into is like an open-source world, like Linus Torvalds releasing the free Linux operating system and how that's revolutionized that whole industry. I think people sharing their secrets on making their business successful and, like, how to grow sprouts so that people could now do this too is the next wave of the future, and it's not about money, but it's sharing free information to enrich other people's lives and just, instead of enriching their bank account. But at the Got Sprouts, I think the coolest thing there was that I was able to really to show people how they could grow food even in the middle of winter, you know, even in their kitchen, in their home that they're already heating anyways during the wintertime. I mean, they're growing in South Florida. In South Florida, the weather is atrocious for growing little baby sprouts. So actually, they have to do some cooling. They have fans because they have high humidity and high mold occurring in the sprouts if they're not keeping fans on and whatnot. But, you know, the power of that video is to really let people know no matter where you live, you could start growing some food, you know, in your kitchen with just a few simple devices, whether you want to grow sprouts or if you want to call them microgreens in trays, or whether you just want to germinate some seeds in a small sprout bag or sprouting device and, you know, eat your foods fresh instead of, you know, buying them out of the grocery store where they've been packaged and shipped and hydro-cooled and they finally get to you.
He said, too, you don't need big grow lights or anything to grow sprouts. As long as you can see yourself in the room, that's enough light. Just go ahead and do it. Now, let's get back to your own place. How big is it, and how much of your own food can you grow there?
Well, you know, my place is standard. I think it's around about 8,000 square feet is my lot. The house takes up about 1,600 square feet, and so then I have the rest of the lot to play with. And what I like to think is I like to maximize every square inch of my place, and if I don't have a pathway that's just wide enough for my wheelbarrow to get through or a pathway just wide enough to walk through to harvest some things. You know, everything else is prime for planting out. I built raised beds, and I had a master plan and built it all out, and the front yard's all decked out on the raised beds, and the backyard has raised beds along the edges and actually two greenhouses where I could further grow things, you know, and I don't heat my greenhouses because one of my mottos is, you know, I want to just keep my hands off. I want to let the plants fend for themselves, and if I need to do too much work to keep them alive, we'll just let them go the way of the West, and I'll grow something else that's going to be a lot easier because I don't want to have to, you know, baby my each and every plant. But yeah, I mean, I grow 90 to 95% of my vegetables year round, and so like most of my vegetable consumption are leafy greens and other things. That's especially what I'm growing in the winter time, like it is right now. I do more fruiting crops like the tomatoes and the peppers in the summertime, which I eat many of them, but I also dehydrate and store them, you know, for the winter.
And you take a lot of those greens and you consume them as juice. So tell us about juicers.
Right, yeah. So what I recommend is that, you know, I want people getting back to eating more of a plant-centric diet. And, you know, one of the best ways to include more of the leafy greens, especially in your diet, because, you know, we're not set up with a digestive system like the cow. And unfortunately, most people don't chew their food well enough. I mean, when you're a baby, you know, people buy baby food or hopefully make baby food to feed babies because babies don't have teeth. But just because we have teeth, we are supposed to use them and break down every mouthful of food into mush to get the optimal digestion that the baby gets when they eat the baby food. But unfortunately, in this day and age, we're all so rushed. You got your job. You got to get there on time and whatnot. People just take two chews and they swallow or three chews and they swallow. And I think it's really important to, especially on the leafy greens that are so fibrous, to break those down so that we can get the optimal digestion out of them. And that's what the juicer does. The juicer literally does the work for you to break the food down. I mean, if you think about it, if we eat a carrot, right, out one side of us, the front side for us guys, comes the liquid, and the back side comes the solid. So we are just separating out the liquids and the solids, and that's what the juicer does. It literally separates out the fiber, which, yes, we do need fiber in our diet, and I eat a salad every night in addition to the juice I'm getting. But we need fiber to clean us out, but otherwise the fiber is a hindrance of the absorption of some of the nutrition in the food. So when we take out the fiber by juicing, then we almost literally have like a shot of instant energy that's digested, some say, within 30 minutes of drinking. So, I mean, this is the, I don't drink coffee, I drink fresh juice. The other day, actually, I had apples juice with wheatgrass. So that was a pretty interesting juice there.
I owned one of those Breville high-speed juicers, and John, it was so noisy it frightened me, and eventually a plastic part burned out and they wouldn't replace it. So now I'm thinking a slow-speed juicer is the way to go, you say, to preserve the nutrients. Is that right?
Right. There are many different kinds of juicers, and, you know, a juicer is not a juicer is not a juicer, just like if you need a vehicle to get from point A to point B. I mean, they got cars, they got trucks, they got sport cars, and depending on what you need to do, like if you're going to go on a hot date, you might want to take a sports car, but if you're, you know, a construction guy and you need to haul some 2x4s and some 4x8s, you might need a truck. So juicers are kind of like the same thing. You want to get the juicer that's going to do best for your particular task. So the Breville juicer is a high-speed centrifugal ejection juicer. And while those are good because, you know, they're relatively fast and you could juice quickly and make a lot of juice in a limited amount of time, especially if you're really busy, they're not good for juicing things like leafy greens. They're really good at juicing things like carrots. But, you know, that's the kind of juicer I started with. And, you know, that style of juice has been out for many years. But just recently there's been a big change in the way juicers work. They've gone to the lower RPM or slow juicers, which run instead of like 10,000 RPM like the Breville, which some people have complained, sounds like an airplane taking off of my kitchen, John. They want a juicer that's not that loud because it's just so kind of violent, I like to say, in some ways. Plus, you know, the nutrition it creates because it is spinning so fast, it introduces more air or oxidation to your juice. So that's what happens when you scratch your car and, you know, it starts rusting. And, you know, while it's better to drink oxidized juice made in a high-speed juicer than a packaged and bottled juice that has been pasteurized and even loses more nutrition, it's far better, in my opinion, to drink a juice made with a slow juicer that's a lot more gentler and doesn't include, you know, as much air. And also, in some cases, as in the case of leafy greens, which I think are the most beneficial thing to juice myself, it will extract more juice.
And, John, what is at livingfoods.com?
So the living-foods.com is probably one of my first websites. Actually, I started back in 1997 to share my experience and information about the style of diet that I'm on a plant-based raw living food diet where, you know, I actually don't heat up any food. So that might sound, you know, abnormal to some people. But if you think about it, in nature, all the animals in nature, none of them eat the food. They eat it all raw. So I teach that there, and that's an old website. It hasn't been updated in a long time, but it still has a lot of good information. My newer site where I teach my dietary stuff is actually called okraw.com, where I also have more videos where I teach about my diet and lifestyle if people are interested in that.
Okraw.com. Got that. Well, back on YouTube, some of your most watched items show people how to grow specific crops like cucumbers at homes without chemicals or pesticides. About 250,000 people looked at that one. So how is the home gardener supposed to deal with pests that always show up without using these toxic products?
Well, you know, we've all been led to a bill of goods like, oh, there's pests. The solution is to spray pesticides to take them out. And, you know, I kind of look at things a little bit differently. Like, how does nature work, and would nature spray pesticides? Well, in nature, there's a few things that happen. Number one, the plants reproduce so fast that any pest can't really take a foothold. So that's one of the solutions I like to teach is to grow more food than you need, because guess what? The pests are going to get some, and that's all right, because, you know, they're creatures on the earth too. And, you know, I allocate growing some extra every year just so that if the pest devastates some of my crops, then I still have food to eat, and I grow different varieties because some pests might like this variety of tomato but not mess with your other variety. Another thing I advocate is, you know, in nature, plants have their own protection built in. Like, we have an immune system to fight off viruses and colds and whatnot so that we don't get sick. The plants have their own, quote-unquote, immune system, too. And, you know, their immune system is that, like, if we ate McDonald's, for example, our immune system won't be so strong, but if we had a good diet rich in fruits and vegetables and antioxidants and vitamins and minerals, our immune system's stronger. So the plants are the same way. If you're feeding your plants like Miracle-Gro or some other, you know, chemical fertilizers, you know, your plants, yeah, they'll live and they'll probably produce for you, but they're not going to be as healthy as plants grown in rich compost, soil humates and rock dust trace minerals, and even using some stuff called insect frass, which will actually help the plants produce chitin, which actually breaks down the insect shells. So basically, when an insect or hard-bodied insect comes to eat your plant, it'll, like, get a taste of this chitin stuff, which will literally start dissolving its exoskeleton. And then if you're going to go to some other plant like your neighbor's who doesn't have this growing in rich soil. Another thing that is really easy, especially if you're doing a home garden on a smaller scale, you know, the easiest control to use for pests is manual control. So what does that mean? That means going out and inspecting your plant and smushing the bugs or picking them off and feeding the snails to your chickens, for example. You know, and that's just really easy. But on a mass scale, when one farmer's trying to farm thousands of acres with tractors and stuff, they want it super easy, and they may not necessarily care about the environment, and they're not doing it for their health like I'm growing for my health. In addition, they have also many more organic controls to use that are, you know, organic and safer to use than, you know, than the toxic chemical pesticides.
Well, John, as we wrap up, you've toured a lot of gardens around the U.S. and even outside the U.S. Is there one more that you'd like to tell us about?
Wow, there's just so many gardens that I've visited. I can't really think of any one particular episode that I liked a lot. I mean, each one, I always learn something new. And, you know, that's what I really want to encourage people, whether they're visiting a community garden in their neighborhood, watching one of my videos. I always encourage people to have an open mind and to see what you can glean from the farm or the video you're watching of mine, because I believe, you know, and there's always something to learn that could improve your life and also improve, you know, how effective you are as a gardener at home.
Well, John Kohler, go ahead. Tell us your website for your juicing business and where to find your work on YouTube.
Sure. So my juicing business is discountjuicers.com, and that's where I sell the juicers and the blenders and the dehydrators, which allow people to eat more fresh fruits and vegetables. I do have a YouTube channel associated with that as well, where I demonstrate juicers and compare them side by side, because that seems to be a big question, and that's at youtube.com/rawfoods. I also educate people about gardening, which is my biggest passion, and it's my number one hobby right now. I do this completely for fun and just because I want to give back to people and, you know, let them know what I think the best food on earth is, the things they could grow in their front yard, and that's at growingyourgreens.com. And then finally, the last website, which I did mention earlier, is about my specific plant-based raw uncooked diet at okraw.com.
Listeners, you can find all those links, plus a few of my favorite John Kohler videos, in my show blog at ecoshock.info. John, thank you so much for all your fabulous work.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Check out my Radio EcoShock blog for links to a dozen or more John Kohler videos to get you started. John has re-inspired me. I was drinking vegetable juice in Los Angeles back in the 70s, practically as a kid. I was growing lots of veggies in the 80s. It's just one of those things that keeps coming back. We learn again and start again. I bought a juicer this week, but not from John. He only sells in the United States. A local drugstore chain had a sale on the Big Boss Vita Press. It's a slow juicer that squeezes the veggies with a rotating auger. The Breville high-speed juicers are great if you're into hard fruits like apples and maybe carrots or beets, but they don't do well with leafy greens in my experience. Plus, a Breville has an 850-watt motor sounding like an airplane in your kitchen. It turns at about 10,000 revolutions per minute instead of maybe 100 or less by the slow juicers. By contrast, my slow-speed juicer needs just 150 watts, means it used less power, and I can run it from my solar panel. The whole process with slow juicing is much more relaxing. The VitaPress cost me $169, with a 1-year in-store warranty and a 2-year factory warranty. I seriously considered buying one of the Omega models John shows in his videos, but in the end, I just couldn't afford more than $300 for a juicer. I'll let you know how the cheaper one works out. Last night we had a super green drink, including a bargain on organic black kale. I can't wait for the local farmer's market to open. Hopefully by next year we'll be in a place where we can grow most of our own again.
Back to the land we must all lend a hand. To the farms and the fields we must go. There's a job to be done, though we can't fire a gun. We can still do a bit with the
John is pretty well feeding himself from a standard house lot in California. He's got several videos of tips for more northern folks, from the compost heated greenhouse through sprouting greens anywhere inside in the depths of winter. For those who heard about my experiment with a little planter and indoor lights, I can report trying a couple of things. First of all, I asked myself, what would some listeners do? There's limited choices in some places. I tried the Walmart brand of planting soil, which promised it would need little watering. That turned out about as useless as I thought it would. The plants were starting to die off because the soil stays way too wet. I carefully removed my small plants, chucked the Walmart stuff, and went with a version of Mel's mix, 1/3 peat, 1/3 vermiculite, not perlite, vermiculite, and some compost. I also added some clean sand heated up in the oven to get rid of any outside life in it. Small containers benefit from sand, I think, to help drain the soil. Now my kitchen herbs and lettuce are doing great. I had to cut back the hours of light for the lettuce and move it back a bit because it was heading straight to seed under the light all that time from the T5 fluorescent running 16 hours a day. Things have grown so fast, I had to move the lights up 6 inches in the first 2 weeks. I also like having that fake sunlight in my studio as I prepare Radio EcoShock in the dark spring of rainy Vancouver. Burning just 24 watts, it's not too hard on the atmosphere, I suppose. Pretty soon we'll have the real stuff from the real sun. My thanks to listeners who responded with ideas for a seed show. I've got something in the works for that. I've also appreciated the feedback on our Facebook page and the blog and from the contact form on our website at ecoshock.org. I can't promise answers for everyone, but I do read it. Listeners provide a lot of direction and tips for this program. That's the way it should be. I appreciate your support. Stay tuned for one of the great voices of the environment, Helen Caldicott.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You've just tuned in to NHK World. We're covering the situation here in Japan. According to the Nuclear Power Security Agency, 5 nuclear power plants in northeastern Japan have been shut down.
Now, at the stricken Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant, Japanese police will try spraying water from outside the quake-crippled reactor building to cool down its storage pool for nuclear fuel. The task force says it's crucial to restore the cooling systems as soon as possible to stop the radioactive leakage.
The Japanese government is poised to release information about the accident at Fukushima Daiichi that it initially withheld for fear of causing panic. The undisclosed data projects the spread of radiation from the nuclear plant.
Tokyo Electric Power Company says the concentration of radioactive substances in the water in the turbine building for the number 2 reactor on Sunday was 100,000 times higher than is usual in water inside a reactor.
Japan's Nuclear Safety Commission says that people living in the area with high radiation levels should evacuate voluntarily because there is no immediate likelihood that the plant will stop emitting radiation.
In last week's show, I ran selections from the symposium, The Medical and Ecological Consequences of the Fukushima Nuclear Accident. That was in New York, March 11th and 12th, and it was funded by the Helen Caldicott Foundation and Physicians for Social Responsibility. That program covered 5 key myths about the Fukushima disaster, things like it isn't over, the unreported extra dangers to women and small children, and the myth that wildlife is thriving at Chernobyl in the Ukraine, despite the continuing radiation there. If you missed that program, go get it as a free MP3 download from our website at ecoshock.org. That New York symposium was full of surprises. The key driving force behind it was the 75-year-old anti-nuclear campaigner, the world-renowned Dr. Helen Caldicott. She helped fund it, along with other medical professionals in the group Physicians for Social Responsibility. By the second day, understandably, Helen was tired. It was her turn to speak. But by the end, I was touched and re-stimulated by our duty here to care for humans, wildlife, and all life. We are part of a giant living planet, attached and responsible. Helen Caldicott reminded me why I make Radio EcoShock every week and why you come to listen. Here she is at the March Symposium in New York City.
We're all tired, and I'm exhausted, and Marley's even more tired. And on that note, I want to formally thank Marley Lightfoot for actually putting this symposium together. So I had a big concept, and we put it together. I did this for 2 reasons. One, that I was so annoyed and frustrated with the arrogance and ignorance of the media about radiation biology after Fukushima, especially with one George Monbiot at The Guardian, who knew nothing about internal emitters or anything, and they kept saying people haven't dropped dead, and they're still saying that I thought it was appropriate to sort of set up a medical conference for 2 days, like medical school, to teach them the basic elements of radiation biology. And that's why I put this symposium together, to educate the media. Unfortunately, there were representatives here, but we could have had a lot more, so they're not really quite turned on to it yet. And I suppose I have to say that the American media really worries about Americans, like a little girl trapped down a well or that sort of thing. And it was interesting to note that when the sailors came along, that was very pertinent because they're Americans. And I don't think people can extrapolate too much in this country to Japanese, number one. And number two, when Chernobyl happened, I can remember being on a telephone in the Texas airport talking to an ABC radio commentator who said, well, they're just Russians. And I was absolutely flabbergasted. I said, I'm a physician, and every human life is precious. So that attitude of insularity prevails, and it's prevailed today, not amongst you, but amongst the media. And this is the sort of capital of the media, of certainly the United States, and in fact the world, because this is where the United Nations is situated, and there are media representatives from all over the world. And we're in a very serious situation. Arjun Makajani, who's been referred to several times, has written a note that he wants read, and I will do that. But I want to say that I held a symposium called Nuclear Power and Global Warming, I don't know, about 7 years ago, and David Freeman was there. And we had scientists from all perspectives, for nuclear power, against nuclear power, for 2 days. And at the end, David Freeman, who I'd never met before, stood up and said, we can get all the energy we need in the United States with no carbon and no nuclear. And I said, David, you're kidding. I mean, couldn't believe it. He said, yes, we can. So I then raised the money and commissioned Arjun to do a study. He was sceptical too. He's a physicist. And he came out with a study which is absolutely remarkable, called carbon-free, nuclear-free, where it showed that, in fact, by, well, he said 2050, but it's now 2030, but it's probably sooner than that, America could be carbon-free, nuclear-free. And we owe that study to David's vision that he's had ever since, you know, he was with Jimmy Carter and Nixon. So I want to honour David for this vision. And on that note, I would say that when America was attacked at Pearl Harbor, by God, it only took about 9 months to convert every single industry into making weapons. You can't tell me that we can't do that within 9 months to a year. Convert all these industries into making solar panels, put them on every single house in America, like in Germany. I saw them all over Austria. Germany gets not much sun, but you don't need much sun to generate solar power. Have windmills all over the country. As mentioned, there's enough wind west of the Mississippi to supply three times the energy this country currently needs. We need to upgrade the grids. Easy. Where's the FDR that will lead us towards sanity and survival? I see that not happening in this Congress, who are pathetic. I see it not happening with Obama, who's now become a captive and maybe always was of the corporations. So how do we have a revolution to stimulate that? Well, let me tell you about a revolution that we had in the 80s. When I first came here in 1978, almost every American I spoke to said it's better to be dead than red. I said, what? What? And they said, no, we don't want to be communists. And I said, well, what about the pygmies in Africa? And they said, this is true. They don't want to be communists either. And they would rather have a nuclear war than be communists. And it was a mass psychosis. This country was psychotic. Anyway, so I thought this is crazy. So I got together Physicians for Social Responsibility and we recruited 23,000 doctors and we had 153 chapters. And I taught them how to go on the media and talk about this and write letters and op-ed pieces. And we literally deluged the media with the medical consequences of nuclear war, which started with a symposium at Harvard where we had wonderful faculty, including many of the old fellows from the Manhattan Project, George Kisiakowski, Vicky Wisecoff, Philip Morrison, and they talked about their guilt, really, of building nuclear weapons, and a lot of them were dedicated to nuclear power because they thought that would fix things and alleviate their guilt, but they all went to their graves feeling tremendous guilt. And these symposia were interesting because afterwards the media said, well, what are doctors talking about nuclear war for? That's political. And we said, no, actually, it's medical. That nuclear war will create the final epidemic of the human race. And they started to buy it. And the Archbishop of Boston would get up in the morning and there'd be in the Boston Globe a map of Boston with concentric circles of destruction, vaporization out to 5 miles of everyone, third-degree burns out to 20 miles, a holocaust of 3,000 square miles burning, and the Archbishop would say, I don't think Jesus would like this. And then we went around to most capital cities where we had symposia. People were scalping tickets at the university in Seattle. We had a huge one in Los Angeles. And we got a lot of media attention and people started to think about it. So that after only about going 2 years for this, and I had an agent in Hollywood who worked for me for free, the media didn't want to put on a boring doctor, Australian doctor in a tweed suit talking about the medical effects of nuclear war. I mean, that would turn everyone off and then they wouldn't buy their hemorrhoid cream or their stuff to stick their false teeth on the top of their mouth or this pill for erectile dysfunction. You have to keep the audience happy in order to buy the stuff that they advertise. So she'd say, look, I'll give you Lily Tomlin and Sally Field if you'll take Helen Caldicott. So they liked that. They were the sort of hook to hang me on. Anyway, I'll tell you, the first time I think I did Donahue for an hour, and Lily, I got in there, and Lily's pacing up and down the corridor, she's very smart, reading these notes so that she could go on and talk about it. Sally sat there having her hair curled and her face all fixed up. By the time I got on, in half an hour, Lily had covered the whole waterfront. She'd done the whole thing. But it was a wonderful way to educate the people, and that's what we did in PSR. We created a revolution so that by the end of 5 years, from most people supporting the concept of better dead than red, 80% of Americans were opposed to nuclear war. And I met with Reagan in the White House and quickly established a doctor-patient relationship with him and held his hand, and we went on for an hour and a quarter, and I estimated his IQ to be sort of average 100. And I actually came out and said I thought he had impending Alzheimer's, which he did. But it was interesting because I thought I got nowhere with the man, and he didn't understand anything. His figures were inaccurate. He didn't understand the technology. But after that, he started to say nuclear war must never be fought and can never be won. And he started working with Gorbachev, who saw doctors on Moscow television talking about the medical effects of nuclear war, which turned Gorbachev around. We got a million people in Central Park, black lesbians from Harlem, Southern Christian Baptists, Mormons from Salt Lake City. Everyone marched in and in and in. Took all day to get a million people in Central Park. The biggest demonstration, I think, in the history of this country. Then they did an end run around us and started talking about, this was Reagan, war in space, Star Wars, missile defense, all of that stuff. You know, he had a yellow shield over America and the missiles would go boink, boink. That's what he thought would help America. But we became so powerful that the whole of the American population was supporting an end to nuclear weapons. And so then the Cold War ended, which was a result of our work and Gorbachev understanding the medical effects of nuclear war. Now, that was the second American revolution, for sure. It was sagacious, peaceful, Gandhian, and it was education which did the trick. And I'd go into Congress, and Tip O'Neill, who's a lovely fellow from Boston, he'd come out and say, well, he was chairing the House, and he'd come out and say, what can I do for you, doctor? Because he knew we had 80% of people behind us, and that's political power. And I'd say, Tip, I want you to play our film, The Last Epidemic, on every TV monitor in the Congress, and he did it. And when Tip retired, he said the two most important things he ever did in Congress was the nuclear weapons freeze, which passed. Ed Markey and I worked on that. And also the Mary Knoll nuns, who he championed, who were killed in Central America. So the only way to turn this country upside down, as Jefferson said, an informed democracy will behave in a responsible fashion. Now, you see these kids on their cell phones tweeting and twittering and walking along, emailing each other and stuff. They're not reading papers, not watching the news. They do not understand the nuclear age, which they are inheriting. They are inheriting massive quantities of radioactive waste, which will leak in the future, get into the food supply, and over time induce epidemics of cancer, leukemia, and genetic disease, congenital malformations forevermore. You can imagine our descendants waking up in the morning. The food already radioactive, the breast milk radioactive, the babies being born deformed because they're exposed to radiation in utero, which we heard from Dr. Wirth Dalecki, and getting cancer at the age of 6 because they're exposed very early or in utero. That's the heritage we leave to our descendants. And we can talk till the cows come home about nuclear accidents, which are severe. But the most important issue is this radioactive waste piling up all over the world, and no one knows where to put it, and we don't know where to put it, and we never will. And I've been debating with the nuclear industry for 42 years, and they say, don't worry, we're good scientists, we'll find the answer to radioactive waste. They haven't attended to it. I mean, they're like surgeons, you know. We don't clean up after us, we just let the nurses clean up. We're not interested in the waste we create. We're arrogant. Well, so are they. They're interested in building bombs and designing nuclear power. It's all very exciting. So I say to them, well, that's like me saying to a patient, I'm sorry, but you have pancreatic cancer. That's what the CT scan shows. And your prognosis is probably 6 months. But don't worry, I'm a very good doctor. In 20 years' time, I'll find the cure. But there will never be a cure to the storage of radioactive waste. So we're in a very, very, very serious predicament. And as Tim Musso's work shows, that we're not the only ones with genes and who get congenital malformations. All plants and animals have genes, and what we're doing with this radioactive waste, or when it leaks out from reactors or whatever, is producing random, compulsory genetic engineering forevermore. Almost all mutations in genes are deleterious and create disease, although radiation did cause evolution, so fish develop lungs and birds develop wings, and this incredible creature, us, evolved. I think we're an evolutionary aberrant, actually. The thing is that most mutations are deleterious, and I've said for years, you know, we all carry several hundred deleterious mutations in our genes, and I've been parading around platforms forever, and I've just found out I'm a carrier of a disease called hemochromatosis, which is a Mendelian recessive, and my ex-husband carries a gene, and our son has just been diagnosed with hemochromatosis, which is an aberration in iron metabolism and storage. So you can't excrete your iron, and it gets stored in the heart muscle and the liver, and it can do very nasty things. He gets treated by being bled a litre or 2 or 3 litres every couple of months, and his iron level has come down. Now, there's been no sign of genetic abnormalities post-Hiroshima. You know, it can take 20 generations for recessive genes to express themselves. 20 generations until two genes get together for diabetes, cystic fibrosis, phenylketonuria, inborn errors of metabolism. There are over 2,600 diseases we have now described that are genetically inherited. Not many are dominant, in other words, appearing in the next generation, except achondroplastic dwarfs. That's dominant. And I saw a family at Harvard, at Children's Hospital. The mother was an achondroplastic dwarf. The father was normal. They were followed by 6 children, 5 of whom were achondroplastic dwarfs. So it's a toss of the coin each time there's a conception. Many dominant genes are lethal, and the babies are aborted. Most mutations are recessive, and because we won't be alive to see what's going to happen to us, we don't know. We say we don't know. But if you look at Muller's experiments with Drosophila fruit fly in 27, he irradiated the Drosophila and they reproduce every few days. So you've got hundreds of generations and you can watch the progression of a gene that induced a crooked wing being passed on generation to generation to generation. That's genomic progression. We've known it forever. He got the Nobel Prize for it. I learned it in medical school in 1956. We know. And so, we're not seeing it in the survivors at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. We don't expect to see it. That's a silly thing to even say, medically speaking. So we're facing, I guess, the end of the Earth, life on the planet. I said once to Carl Sagan, "Do you think there's any other life in the universe?" He paused for a long time and then he said, "No." And I said, "Why not?" And he said, "Because if any species had reached our stage of evolution, they would have destroyed themselves." So here we are with global warming upon us. We've had the hottest days in Australia we've ever had. It was a day of 120 or 124 degrees the other day. I thought I was going to die. We're in the middle of a forest of eucalyptus trees which explode with the heat. The fires jump miles as cinders fall down. There was a fire 35 kilometres from us. The wind was blowing at 100 k an hour towards us. We had our bags packed, photographs, passports and everything ready to evacuate, and the house would have gone. It's terrifying. And so not only did we have bushfires all over Tasmania and houses lost, people killed, and New South Wales with these awful heat waves, now we've had floods. Huge floods in Queensland, people dying, being swept away in their cars. This is global warming. And I wrote about it in 1991 in If You Love This Planet, and these predictions were all there at that time. And stupidly, I thought, everyone will read the book and they'll fix it. Meanwhile, we're exporting coal from Australia like there's no tomorrow to China. They can hardly breathe over there. I've often said, you know, people buy water in bottles. Plastic bottles that contain BPA and phthalates, which are carcinogenic and hormone mimickers, water comes out of a tap. not out of a plastic bottle. There's an island in the Pacific twice the size of Texas made of plastic. It breaks down to little pieces. The fish feed on it. The birds eat the fish. They also eat the plastic. The albatrosses are feeding it to their babies. They're dying. And still we make more plastic and more plastic and more plastic and more plastic, and we never think about it. But that's kind of beside the point. So I've always said, well, soon it'll be bad enough, we'll be buying oxygen bottles to breathe. Well, that's what they're doing now in Beijing, oxygen bottles. We're really mad. So, as David said, we have to stop burning coal now. This fracking is crazy because, as he pointed out, it gets to about 90% because I'm sure more than 2% leaks from those fracking wells. Coal, oil. Everyone's driving these great big tanks and they drive their little girls to ballet in tanks. I once asked a GE man, what the hell do you think you're doing? He said, well, we're making money. So the true God in this country now is money. Let's be frank, It's not God. No one really believes in God. They just believe in making more money. Oh, they go to church to solve their consciences or the synagogue, but it's money. Money doesn't make the world go round. Money's killing the earth. I go back to what Mary said today, you know, 51, 52% of us are women and we're wimps and we take no stand. We have the babies, we've got the hormones to nurture life, oxytocin, progesterone, estrogen, yet we stand back and let the men proceed. Look at the Congress, full of silly men, you know, trying to outlaw abortion and birth control and mammograms. And I mean, how dare they? And they have no right. And where are we? Nowhere. We can fix global warming. We can stop mining coal. We can stop fracking. And we can stop, you know, we can, as David said, all parking lots in America should be covered with solar panels and electric cars to plug in. So we've got electric cars. I've just been in California. There are hardly any solar panels on the houses. Every house in America should be solarized. And you can't tell me that Americans are not smart. That's how you got rich in the first place. Yeah, you had some natural resources. But you've got a lot of ingenuity. But now all your jobs have gone to China. You don't buy anything here that's made in America. It's all made in China. So no wonder there are no jobs. But by God, could you get going? You could really show the earth what an energy responsible nation will do and become the energy superpower of the world easily. And it's true that we waste up to 30% of the electricity. Well, you do. You leave everything on all the time. Sense of entitlement is amazing. In Australia, we have to switch a switch off, but you don't tend to pull your plugs out. So we can say, I mean, if everyone stopped using clothes dryers, you'd save almost the same amount or a bit less than nuclear power producers. Clothes dryers made by General Electric that makes nuclear power plants, so you've got to have a clothes dryer to use the electricity that they want to sell you, and they make nuclear weapons as well. I don't use clothes dryers. I hang my clothes in the sun. But there's a law in Atlanta that you can't do that because Mrs. Brown next door might see your brassiers and your underpants. And that's kind of rude. How ridiculous. How ridiculous. And dry them by side the furnace in the winter. You know, it's simple, so easy. I ask people where their electricity comes from. They haven't a clue. You walk in those doors like that, the global warming doors or the carcinogenic doors. We need to think about the way we live. We don't walk upstairs. We take an escalator, global warming escalator. So we're killing ourselves to kill ourselves better. So we can fix global warming. We need to educate people through the media. The media is determining the fate of the earth. Similarly, we can close all the reactors down. There's so much data and evidence. We need to get the doctors in particular in the media again, teaching people the medical consequences of nuclear power. And lastly, America and Russia own 97% of the hydrogen bombs in the world. They've each got about 1,000 on hair trigger alert, 3 minutes decision time by Obama and Putin. The Chinese are hacking into the early warning system. They get 1,000 legitimate hackers a day. I don't know how we're still here. Why are they still threatening to blow up the planet? Well, that's what we've got to look at, the etiology. what is the cause of these aberrant behaviours? And it's psychological. It's not how many bombs there are. And, you know, we tend to count money and we count bombs and we count radioactive waste and everything. Let's look at the psychology that determines, or the pathology that is determining these situations. We can abolish nuclear weapons. Obama needs our help. But Americans have become so passive. Now, when I say you spend $1 trillion on killing, socialized killing, which it is in the Pentagon, socialized killing, and you don't even have a free medical care system. In Australia, it's free. You can go to hospital, have a decent operation, anaesthetic, stay for 6 days, costs nothing. That's called a civilized society, right? Well, so we've got to get moving, but the most important thing is to get people like David on the television blasting the hell out of everyone. And maybe Herb to provide a bit of theatre, and to teach people what's going on, and the doctors need to step up to the plate, because this situation, nuclear war will create the final epidemic of the human race, so will global warming within this century, and nuclear power for the rest of time. The Earth is in the intensive care unit, gravely ill, and we are all physicians now to the dying planet. And unless we move and dedicate our total life to saving it, we leave our children nothing. And I think it's terribly important to get down to where we really live. Who do we really love? What would we do to save our child? Will we dedicate our lives like a lioness or a lion protecting the cubs? Forget about all the data and the figures and stuff. Listen to your intuition and you'll know what you've got to do. So I just want to give you a picture of how dire the situation is, how we stay up all night with a dying patient. And we don't even think about tiredness until we hit the wall at 2 a.m. and have to have a hamburger and a milkshake. But you don't think about yourself when you're treating patients. So we mustn't think about ourselves or our lives when we're trying to save the planet, the only life in the universe. Probably. The responsibility is so huge, and I wouldn't talk like this unless I knew there were answers. Abolish the nuclear weapons now, close down all those reactors now, and stop burning fossil fuel now, and fill the country up with solar and wind and geothermal and conservation, and it would make the Americans so proud. They need to be proud of something now. That revolution has to come from you, because I'm 75, I'll probably be dead soon. The proceedings will be published in a book published by the New Press in the next, 6 months or so, so it will be down on the record. But I welcome your own initiatives to do what you must do individually to save the planet. And I want to also honour Alexei Yablokov, who has provided such an enormous amount of important data.
That was Dr. Helen Caldicott speaking in New York City on March 12th at the symposium called The Medical and Ecological Consequences of the Fukushima Nuclear Accident. I hope Helen is wrong about the future of genetic damage in humans. Personally, I don't believe we are coming to an end, but rather a new beginning, albeit with a difficult and strange birth. But it's probably foolish to bet against Dr. Caldicott with all she knows. Once upon the world stage, there can be a process where a strong, honest person can grow bigger than most of us. That is how I think of her. Earth is in a stage of intensive care, Helen Caldicott says. She passes her torch to us, saying we must all become physicians now, caring for life, for everything that lives. Nothing else in life, not the money, the prestige, the highs, the relationships, nothing else matters more than we accept this role. We may have to sit up through the night. None of us here doubts the night will come. I believe life will continue in the morning. Find more links to the New York Symposium and John Kohler's urban gardening tips in my show blog at ecoshock.info. I am Alex Smith. Stay tuned next week for more Hope and Despair with some great guests on Radio EcoShock. Thank you so much for listening.